Good morning, and may it please the court. Helgi Walker for Appellant Verizon Wireless. With the court's permission, I'd like to reserve 3 minutes of my time for rebuttal. In the order on review, the FCC sought to pursue its policy goal of extending the voice roaming rule to cover mobile data services. But it was caught in a legal conundrum. The common carrier provisions of Title II provided the authority for the voice roaming rule, but those provisions were plainly off limits here due to the express statutory bans on treating wireless broadband providers as common carriers. So ultimately, the Commission took the voice roaming rule, carried over its basic substantive requirements into this new context, and adopted the data roaming rule. The Commission also invented a sweeping new theory of authority under Title III's licensing provisions and declared that the rule did not amount to common carrier treatment. That declaration, Your Honors, was in direct conflict with its prior, repeated, and unqualified classification of roaming as a common carrier obligation.
That was a voice roaming interconnected to the switching system, right?
Correct. That was in the context of an interconnected service. This is not non-interconnected, which, Your Honor, makes it a private mobile service, and nobody has disputed that, and therefore clearly within the plain terms of the ban in Section 332, the common carrier ban that I referenced. We believe
on the battle over the common carrier ban, why doesn't Chevron tell us that we have to give deference to the FCC and their interpretation of what?
In NARUC 1, this court said that the agency enjoys no substantial discretion in classifying entities as common carriers. And in Southwestern Bell, Judge Wald applied no deference, and she said, in fact, it's important that we don't allow the agency to expand its regulatory reach by redefining the elements of common carriage. In CSI Aviation, you suggested there might be some deference, but you went on to restate the important test laid out in the AT&T case by Judge Tatel, joined by Judge Garland, that the threshold question in this circuit is whether there's been a delegation of authority at all.
On the Judge Garland part, since you have asked that my opinion in Telecom, in which I gave Chevron deference to the definition of common carrier, should be overturned.
With all respect.
No, it's perfectly fine, but.
Well, I thought about
Judge
that.
Tatel's probably more helpful.
Thought about that some more, Judge Garland, and as I looked at that case more closely, that case was about the interpretation of the term telecommunications carrier.
Which had been defined as common carrier had been used to define telecommunications.
That's true as a matter of agency choice, but in USTA, this court had already said that the term telecom carrier was ambiguous, and therefore you were bound to apply deference.
You think common carrier is not ambiguous? Is that why wouldn't Chevron apply to the definition of common carrier?
Again, extant circuit precedent in NARUC 1 says we don't.
Well, that's not. I don't think that's again, no disrespect. I don't think that's a fair reading of NARUC 1. I think under the circumstances, there was no deference because it was clear. But I don't think that means that they wouldn't have gotten deference if something else was trying to be applied. But what is it specifically about? Is it because the words common carrier define the jurisdiction of the FCC that you think Chevron doesn't apply? Is that why?
It's because the agency is interpreting a clear limitation on its authority, and we think it's basically the job of the court to interpret and apply that ban. And in your NARUC line of cases, you've said that the term common carrier is a well-known term. It's well-defined out of the common law, and we know what it means, and we get to apply it. But I don't want to spend too much time on the point, Judge Garland, because we think their interpretation is unreasonable in any event. We think the case law, this court's definition of common carrier service means that this is common carrier treatment because we've been deprived, obviously, of the discretion to decide whether to deal, but also the discretion to decide on what terms to deal. But even if you are not sure about that, the FCC's own precedents here really ought to answer the question. They've said over and over again that roaming is a common carrier obligation. They haven't denied that here. And so the question becomes whether this rule can be meaningfully distinguished from the voice roaming rule in any substantive way. And they've simply failed to do that. Chairman Jenikowski himself put it well. This rule is based on the substantive, the basic roaming framework of the prior rule. The obligations are essentially the same, to provide service and to do so on regulated terms and conditions.
Can we, your whole case turns on Midwest Video 2. That's what you're arguing. This is a Midwest Video 2 argument, correct? You're arguing
that's our
that,
lead case, yeah. Yes.
So let's talk about that. First of all, the requirements that the commission imposed in Midwest Video 2 were far more common carrier-like than they were than here. I mean, the cable channels, the cable companies in Midwest Video 2 were ordered to set aside specific channels, right, for public use on a first-come, first-served basis, largely without charge. Correct?
Yes.
That's totally different than what you have here, isn't it?
Well, it might have been more so, yeah, more heavily an example of burdensome common carrier regulation, but the essential features under that case and this court's cases have been met, Your Honor.
And it distinguished Midwest Video 1, right, where the commission had imposed requirements on cable television about who they can serve under what condition, and the court distinguished that. It said that it had not abrogated their control, whereas in the public access rule it had. So there's clearly room for the FCC to impose common carrier-like requirements on non-common carriers without running afoul of the statute, isn't there?
Well, with all respect, I'd like to answer your questions about Midwest Video. Right. There, what was important was that the system operators, Midwest Video 2. Yeah. What was important was not that there had been a specific channel set aside. What was important was that the owner of the system, the operators, had been deprived of the discretion to decide who was going to use them and what was going to be transmitted over them.
And the commission's rule here is different from that. It leaves discretion to the carriers to decide who and under what circumstances to sign roaming arrangements with. Now, there are limits on it, but they do have their discretion, whereas they didn't in Midwest Video 2.
With all respect, Your Honor, that is not what the rule does. The FCC, in its brief, repeatedly says that the rule merely requires, quote, offers to negotiate. Right. What the rule says that we must offer data roaming arrangements. And then in paragraph 40 of the order, the FCC says, we will require covered entities to offer data roaming arrangements to those who have asked for them. That obligation is a flat obligation that applies unless one of the two limited technical exceptions is triggered. So it's a flat obligation to offer the service. That's then backed up by some very coercive measures in paragraph 79 through 81. The FCC said there in the order that we have the power to order parties into agreements. We have the power to set the terms and conditions. We will even order the provision of service on an interim basis. We will impose fines and forfeitures for negotiating without an intent to perform and for undue delay. When you take all of that together, Judge Tatel, that is a very onerous regime. What the FCC was doing, with all respect to my colleagues, was to make this look less onerous than the voice roaming rule. But when you add up the plain terms of the rule, which again they misstated in their brief over and over again, with paragraph 79 through 81, it adds up to the same thing, a compulsion to provide the service.
Look at the actual rule, though. Are you talking about the rule or the order? The rule is 47 CFR 20.1.
Right.
Right? That says a facilities-based provider of commercial mobile services data is required to offer roaming arrangements on commercially reasonable terms and conditions subject to the following limitations.
Right.
That's the rule we're talking about.
Correct.
And it says providers may negotiate the terms on an individualized basis.
Right. The FCC said in their brief that all we have to do is offer to negotiate, as if all they were trying to do was get us into a conference room and talk. That's just incorrect. The rule says we have to offer arrangements, plans for the provision of roaming. And elsewhere in the order, they actually drop the word arrangements and just say we have to offer roaming. To who? To people who have already said that they want it. The reasonable terms and conditions part is just something that has to be sorted out later. But the basic obligation, the fundamental obligation to offer the arrangements, i.e. the service, to those who want it, to all comers,
right,
on commercially reasonable terms and conditions, and that will be sorted out by the FCC. But we have, we can't say no.
That is still very different than the common carrier obligation to serve anyone on any terms, right? First come, first serve.
We are compelled to serve anybody who can make, and this is the language of NARUC 1, anybody who wishes to use the service and can make legal and practical use of it. The exceptions just go to technical compatibility. So if you're incompatible...
Well, there's commercially reasonable terms also.
I think that only shows the common carrier nature of this, Your Honor, because...
Well, but the Commission says commercially reasonable is different from just and reasonable.
I don't... think, well, to use is Judge Garland's word, I think that beggars belief when...
Well, but it's a facial challenge, right?
I call this a direct review of a rulemaking
but
order.
It's still a facial challenge, too. It hasn't been applied. I mean, if the Commission applies it in under circumstances which make it look more common carrier than it is, you can always challenge that.
Your Honor, Your Honor, their argument on that score goes purely to the terms and conditions language, the determination of commercial reasonableness under 85 and 86, those paragraphs of the order. The flat obligation to provide the service to people who want it is not going to be affected by any future proceedings.
Well, I think that is a fair point. That is, we have to decide whether the requirement to accept roaming by itself, even limited by... negotiating the terms and the terms being commercially reasonable, whether that one thing makes you a common carrier.
I think that thing, Your Honor, but also the fact, even though the Commission says it's going to flesh out what commercially reasonable means, I think they've already done that in the order because they've listed these factors. And these factors are the exact same ones that they use under the voice roaming rule to adjudicate Section 201's just and reasonable standard. That is the classic common carrier standard.
It's actually not. So this is a question I have. So When the words common carrier came about, what are they a reference to? They're a reference to the Interstate Commerce Commission's use, right?
Right.
And so what is a common carrier? A common carrier has to deal with everyone. They have to file their rates. The rates have to be just and reasonable, and in the old days, that meant they had to be based on cost. Cost plus profit. This looks nothing like that. And it is true that, as this court discusses in Orloff, that the FCC has relaxed its view of common carrier. But if we take what common carrier actually meant at common law, the FCC, and say that it has to be that, then the FCC would never have been able to relax in the first place. There could have been no quasi-competitive application of the common carrier.
If I may, the defining characteristic of common carrier status historically, and even under the ICA and the Cullum Report, the legislative history from 1887 that we cite in our briefs, what that shows and what the FCC has maintained, even as it has loosened some requirements, is the basic indifference as to whom you may serve. The Cullum Report says that a common carrier is defined by the fact that there is an indifference as to whom they may serve. We have been deprived of the discretion as to whom we may serve, but also on what terms. And that does fall squarely within Midwest Video 2, because there the charges were regulated for what appropriateness. That's even farther from the language of just and reasonable. But I don't have much time left, Your Honor. I do want to shift to the fact that if you're not sold on that piece of our argument, which we do think is absolutely correct under this court's case law, which emphasizes the quasi-public nature of the holding out above all else as the touchstone, the FCC cannot run away from its own repeated statements that roaming is a common carrier obligation. I counted unscientifically 18 separate definitive times in their prior roaming orders that they said it is a common carrier obligation.
But it said that in the context of a common carrier, right?
Right, because the defining nature of a common carrier.
It doesn't necessarily mean that that roaming is a common carrier function everywhere else.
It means that when you are required to provide a basic service to anybody who wants it and can make technical use of it, that's a common carrier style duty. What the statutes prohibit is treating us That's the language of the statute, treating us as if we were common carriers. But the second piece of this on the record before you that I think is important is that the record, the procedural history of this rule shows that it's just an outgrowth of the voice roaming rule. The commission said we're just carrying over the basic substantive framework, and we are changing the scope of the rule to cover, as Judge Garland mentioned, non-interconnected services. This rule was proposed as a, quote, extension of the voice roaming rule. The order says twice that it complements the voice roaming rule because it expands the scope. And as I mentioned, Chairman Jankowski said it carries over the basic substantive framework. The duties, Your Honor, are the same. And I think it's just difficult to conclude that it's even reasonable, putting aside the deference question for a moment, it's not reasonable for them to maintain this fiction that this isn't a common carrier style regulation because we changed some words here and there to make it look less like the voice roaming rule, when what is clear, if I may emphasize, is that they're trying to expand their regulatory domain into internet-based information and private mobile services. And this court said in cases like Comcast that you, and also Southwestern Bell, that the FCC cannot kind of maintain these fictions in order to try to reach areas where Congress has not given them a clear warrant to regulate.
That brings us to your argument that they don't have a statutory basis for this, right?
Correct.
So what about 303B? Why doesn't 303B prescribe the nature of service to be rendered? Isn't that what's happening here? It's saying to AT&T and Verizon, if you want to have a license to do this, part of the service you must provide, prescribe the nature of the service, is roaming.
Yes, well, that's...
And remember, we're at Chevron 2 here. This is a Chevron issue.
For purposes of this...
This part.
This argument.
I will assume what this court tells me to assume when I'm standing here. I thank you for pointing out the language of 303B.
Yeah.
What the statute says, and by the way, this provision arises in the context of 303, which has a lot of provisions that go to kind of spectrum management, yes, and classification and frequency, mm-hmm, use and kind of things of a technical nature. Mm-hmm. And the context does matter. But the language says may prescribe the nature of the services to be rendered. Mm-hmm. This rule doesn't prescribe the nature, say the sort or the kind or the type of services to be rendered. It dictates to whom the service shall be rendered, and then, Your Honor, it regulates the contract terms and conditions of that provision of service, including even price regulation.
I think that's unambiguous.
I think it does not on its face include any authority to impose this kind of substantive economic regulation. There's not one case in which the FCC has ever been allowed to impose this kind of substantive economic regulation on a licensee under 303B. And the Supreme Court's case in Carroll does put some parameters on 303B. And this court cited Carroll just last term in the environmental case, so it's still very much good law. There the Supreme Court said one thing you can't do under the licensing provision is regulate the lawfulness of a contract between a licensee and a third party. That's exactly what this rule does.
Carol, they wanted to declare the contract null and void. That's not being done here. That was a contract that had already been entered into. Right?
Correct, but the Supreme Court gives us rules of law, not fact-based holdings. And the rule of law there was that FCC, you can do a lot of things to licensees, but one thing you can't do is purport to say whether somebody can have, or in this case has to have, a contract with a third party. Under this rule, Your Honor, the FCC gets to say that our contracts are unlawful under federal law because they don't meet the standard of reasonableness that the commission has set out. And indeed, the commission can force us to enter into contracts against our will with third parties. Where is that on the face of 303B? And in cases like AT&T, Judge Tatel and Judge Garland fortunately agreed there that what the FCC had done with regard to the actual authorization requirement on slamming was not on the face of 248, I think it was. And given that it wasn't on the face of 248 and that similar kinds of requirements appeared elsewhere in the Act, here, of course, we have the basic duty to furnish service and to do so on on reasonable terms and conditions in 201 and 202, which does not exist in Title III. There you said that we're not going to imply or read into a provision that kind of authority. We think that analysis fully applies here. And indeed, if I could make another point about the interaction between Title II and Title III, as I mentioned, there's nothing in Title III that looks like the basic duties of Title II. And in fact, when Congress passed this ban, the 332C2 ban, it also said in C1, we do import the basic provisions of Title II as to commercial providers, but they didn't do that with respect to private mobile service. So the Commission just doesn't have that kind of authority here.
Can I ask you, this raises a question that really probably goes to your arbitrary and capricious argument, but in T-Mobile's brief they say, as a practical matter, for large parts of the country, a GSM carrier's only potential roaming partner is AT&T, and a CDMA carrier's only potential roaming partner is Verizon. Is that correct?
We haven't challenged that.
Okay, so your position then is you can simply refuse to allow roaming by anyone. Is that right? So anyone who wants to be able to roam in large parts of the country has to contract with you?
I don't know the answer to that.
Well, your position is no one can that the FCC can't require you under any circumstances in any way with any degree of flexibility to accept roaming from another carrier. Isn't that right? Isn't that your position?
No, Your Honor, it's not. It's okay. That this rule before you is akin to and tantamount to treating us as if we were common carriers by forcing us to deal, by depriving
under us. Under what circumstance, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but it's the same point, so you can answer altogether. So under what circumstance could you be compelled, if any, to permit roaming from another carrier? You said, my question was, can you ever be, is there any way in which the FCC could compel you to permit roaming, and you said maybe there is, but not this rule. So give me an example of what you're thinking.
Of where they could?
Yes.
I don't see the statutory authorization for that. I mean, there's nothing in these licensing provisions, which are used to basically manage spectrum, that speaks to data roaming in the first place. And so...
To be clear then, your view is... If you win this case, you could say we're not allowing roaming, period, from anybody who is not a Verizon customer. And therefore, no other carrier will be able to sell services to anybody who wants to go outside of that carrier's area. Is that right?
Two answers, Judge Garland. First, our legal position is that the compulsory provision of that kind of service amounts to prohibited treatment that Congress expressly roped off here. But secondly,
you can't legally be compelled.
Not legally, not in light of these clear congressional statements of intent to fence this service off from that kind of compulsory offer. But my second point, Your Honor, is that we've been doing these agreements. We do enter into them. We didn't think there was a need for this rule in the first place. We've entered into quite a lot of them, as the record shows.
Commercially reasonable terms?
We believe they are commercially reasonable.
So then you actually have no disagreement with the rule, other than at some point you're going to dispute what a commercially reasonable term is, I guess.
No, Your Honor, because what has been taken away from us is the ability to say no and to say when we do want to enter into agreements.
So that means the ability to not, to say no totally in order to drive another company out of business, or to say no in order to have a term that is not commercially reasonable. That's what you want. You want both of those authorities.
Sometimes we say no because we like to wait for a little bit until a new service or a new network has been rolled out, and we don't want to have wholesale customers basically until we know that that's working. So sometimes we want to decide when to be able to do that.
Is that inconsistent with the rule?
Yes.
It seems like a reasonable argument, but it's not clear to me that you couldn't do that under the rule.
I think it is, because the rule says, and the rule says, and this is backed up by paragraph 40, we must offer arrangements unless the two limited technical exceptions apply. We have to offer them.
Well, you can condition the effectiveness on the requesting provider's provision of mobile data services to your own subscribers. If it's a new system, it won't be able to do that.
That's just a capacity argument. That's just the ability to manage the traffic. That's another technical technical reason why we could condition, but we'd still have to provide the service, but we get to condition it on the ability to manage the capacity.
I wasn't talking about the technical compatibility argument. It's number four. That's a managing capacity? I thought that one says to condition effectiveness.
Yeah, I'm sorry, you're right. I was thinking of the wrong exception there. But that's still just kind of I call that one of the technical reasons.
And doesn't the phrase commercially reasonable give you latitude to make these sorts of decisions that you wouldn't have under a just and reasonable standard?
No, because the factors are exactly the same, Judge Griffith. We put an addendum at the back of our brief that actually shows side by side the factors that the commission uses to apply the just and reasonable standard of 201 under the voice roaming rule, and the factors that the commission adopted the same factors here in paragraph 85. They said, we think it makes sense to use the same factors. We've just modified them to fit the data context. Where the agency is using the same factors, but all it has done is to change the labels in order to avoid a clear ban on what they're trying to do, I think this court, with all respect, if it's going to exercise its authority under cases like ACLU to do some searching review when they're expanding into new areas like internet-based services, should look behind the label.
Well, I'm sorry, I do. So I'm looking at the factors.
Yes.
There's like 500 of them. There's a lot. You're looking in paragraph 86, is that where they are?
Yes, sir.
So one of them is other special or extenuating circumstances. It seems like you have a lot of the extent and nature of the provider's build-out, the level of competitive harm. It's not exactly restraining with respect to the factors, and it's not clear to me that that the example you gave wouldn't fit among those factors, and if the FCC arbitrarily decided that it doesn't, you could come back here and we would say FCC arbitrary and capricious.
But they've clearly removed our business judgment from the equation, because they think that if we want to sell services based on the superiority of our network that we built and created, that's not a legitimate exercise of our business judgment. So that's off the table. Those kinds of normal competitive considerations, not anti-competitive. That's the whole premise of this order, that it's a public good, that people should all have roaming. And that argument was rejected, I think it was, in NARUC 2. The FCC said, we think it's important to have a nationwide grid. Well, that's exactly the same thing we're saying here, and this court rejected that in NARUC 2. This is a highly compulsory regime, and I just think there's no way to deny the coercive effect of this regime. Even if you think we should not be able to say no, Judge Garland, that's really a policy consideration. That's not warranted. And I'm glad you haven't. That's not warranted under Title III. But I think, is a matter of common sense, when one party to a negotiation has been deprived of the ability to say no and to say walk away, fundamentally changes the nature of the negotiation. If you're dealing with the person who you know has to say yes to you, you have a lot more leverage. It colors everything. It colors everything that we do when people come to us and ask for these arrangements.
NARUC 2 said that you had to offer these lease channels. You had to offer them on a first-come, first-term basis. They had to be non-discriminatory. The FCC is saying you can be discriminatory. That is price discriminatory here.
They actually do not say that. I'd like to draw
I'm just saying that's what they said in the briefs. That is what they said in the briefs.
Right. What they said in the order, Your Honor, is that we can only offer, and this was a clever way to turn the unreasonable discrimination standard of 201 on its head, but essentially to say the same thing. What they said in paragraph 85 is that you can offer different terms and conditions with different parties, as long as differences in terms and conditions reasonably reflect actual differences. That's just the upside down version of the similarly situated no unreasonable discrimination standard of 201. And Judge Garland, you mentioned the flexibility that we might have under these factors. 201 itself gives a fair amount of flexibility. Historically, that never required the provision of service on identical terms and conditions. It was only ever unreasonable discrimination that was prohibited. And there's a lot of play in the joints, even of unreasonable discrimination. So the fact that there might be some flexibility here, I don't think distinguishes this from a Section 201 type of regulation. I know I'm over, Judge Tatel, but if I might just make a closing point, we believe that the relief that we seek, the invalidation of this regulation, is prohibited common carrier regulation, which is not only outside the FCC's authority, but has been affirmatively fenced off by Congress, fits well within the established precedent of the Supreme Court and this court on the cases regarding common carrier prohibitions, and also your cases regarding general agency expansions into new areas in general. But in order to affirm the order here, you'd have to do two things. You'd first have to be willing to overlook what are some pretty glaring inconsistencies between the FCC's prior treatment of roaming and its characterization of this rule. You'd have to give them a full pass on that, applying so much deference that, with all respect, I think it would be to be kind of turning an eye to the facts here. But to affirm, you would also have to open up a vast new frontier of FCC authority over broadband under Title III's licensing provisions. I've read all the jurisdictional cases on this, and I can say to you that no court has ever been willing to go that far. And in fact, it's inconsistent with what you said in Comcast about the agency, the fact that it has some authority in an area here under the licensing provisions to manage spectrum doesn't mean that it has plenary authority.
Well, the problem in Comcast was they were relying on their ancillary authority, and they couldn't point to any underlying statutory authority.
Right.
And here, I mean, I realize you argue that they're this portions of Title III they cite don't support it, but that's what they're resting on.
But right. The principle applies, which is just because you have some authority to manage spectrum doesn't mean you have plenary authority over the licensee. And what they've asserted is plenary authority. There's no limiting principle to what they've asked for, Your Honor. Free iPhones would promote nationwide mobile connectivity just as much as this would. But does the FCC really think that they can do that? But affirming on this theory, which has no limiting principle whatsoever, we have offered some limiting principles under Carroll on our theory. But if you affirm their view, there's really nothing they couldn't do so long as they thought it served the public interest and it had some connection to licensing. I just don't think it's credible that Congress ever really intended for that. But what Congress did intend, and I'll close with this point, is that information services and private mobile services like this, which nobody contests is what we have here in this case, should grow and develop free of even common carrier style regulation. The Commission said that in its wireless broadband classification order. That too is existing precedent that I think significantly hems in their ability to argue seriously that this is permissible.
Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the Court, Peter Carandia for the FCC. Just responding to my friend's closing point, there is
What is the limiting principle?
Well,
her point is that if the court allows you, the commission, to go down this road, there's basically no limit to it at all.
I think the response to that is a very good one, Your Honor offered, which is whatever the potential outer limits of the Commission's Title III authority, the Commission plainly acted within Section 303B, that's the statutory provision that authorizes the Commission to prescribe the nature of the services to be rendered by each licensee. And I think any fair reading of that language plainly authorized the Commission to do what it did here. The Commission also relied on a number of other provisions, including Section 316, which enables the Commission to modify licenses. And the case law says the Commission can modify licenses by generally applicable rulemaking orders.
But their argument is that you have to read this in the context of the common carrier argument in Midwest Video 2.
Correct, Your Honor.
Right.
And on that point, I think that I don't want to interrupt, Your Honor,
no,
if you want to say something else. But on that point, Your Honor, I think the case law quite clearly establishes that it is not true that any limitation on discretion or any obligation to deal in and of itself creates common carriage. Now, how do we know that? Let's look at a case like Southwestern Cable, which the Supreme Court distinguished in Midwest Video 2, if one looks at footnote 16 of Midwest Video 2. What you had in Southwestern Cable was essentially the precursor version of the must-carry rule. So cable systems were required mandated to carry distant signals of local broadcast stations, and the idea was we need to be able to keep broadcast TV as a viable medium, and we now have this new technology of CATV that could be a threat to that. That was clearly a requirement that limited the discretion of the cable systems. It clearly impacted who they had to deal with. Broadcasters could request carriage, and they had to give carriage. And what the commission held, and what the Supreme Court held in Southwestern Cable was that was a proper exercise of the FCC's jurisdiction. Now, it's true that in Southwestern Cable itself, the Supreme Court didn't speak expressly to common carriage. But the result would be inexplicable if that type of rule did impose a common carriage obligation. And the reason for that, Your Honor, is at that time, as now, the statute says the commission cannot treat broadcasters as common carriers, and the Supreme Court explained in subsequent cases that carries over to CATV, which basically acts as a retransmitter of broadcast. So there was an equivalent prohibition on common carrier treatment, and nonetheless the Supreme Court said this is a proper exercise of the FCC's authority. And in Southwestern Cable, and then Midwest Video 2, in footnote 16, the Supreme Court distinguished Southwestern Cable to indicate that it was aware of that common carriage issue and that the result in Southwestern Cable was still correct. I think that shows, in addition to other examples, it cannot be true that any limitation on discretion or any obligation to deal in and of itself is common carriage. A second reason for that, Your Honor, is why would it make sense for the courts to talk about the terms on which to deal? If the only issue was, are you somehow requiring a provider of a service to deal with someone else, the courts would solely refer to that as the criterion for common carriage, but they don't. What they go on to say is we need to look at the terms as well. And when there is an obligation to hold out indifferently or to hold out indiscriminately or to hold out on standardized or, as this court said in Southwestern Telephone Company, generally applicable terms, then there is common carriage. Now, my friend makes the argument that this is all about labeling. Really what the commission did is it came up with this new theory of commercial reasonableness, but in sum and substance it's the same as just reasonable and non-discriminatory. And that is not correct, Your Honor. And the reason for that, the most salient reason, is that the data roaming rule does not include a Section 202 non-discrimination requirement. And this gets into Judge Garland's point about price discrimination. I think it's quite important to understand. The case law under 202 establishes a couple of propositions. The first is a common carrier has to give the same terms to any similarly situated customer who requests them. Of course, that's subject to network capacity, but that's the basic proposition. And that's set forth in the Competitive Telecom Association case we cite at pages 7 and 41 of our brief. A second proposition that's related is a common carrier can only engage in price discrimination if it's based on cost. This was Judge Garland's point. And that's set forth in the cases we cite at page 43 of our brief.
You have to answer Ms. Walker's point, which was that paragraph 85 suggests that it only fits under the traditional definition of what's price discrimination.
This is the perfect segue to my explanation of paragraph 85, Your Honor, which is 85 is making the point that there is considerable latitude, as Judge Griffith noted. What 85 is saying is you can discriminate based on price. If you're going to come up with a reason for discriminating, sure, that has to have a basis in fact. But the point is you are not limited to cost-based rationales. You are not limited to competitive necessity, as you are under the common carriage framework that applies to the voice roaming rule. How do we know that? Well, one could think of some examples. For example, we think it would be commercially reasonable to, if I'm a host, to offer a discount to provider A, but not to extend the same discount to provider B. And that could be for any number of reasons. One reason might be I just know that
now,
B is...
Verizon responded to that argument by saying that a common carrier could also do that.
Well, I think Your Honor's talking about page 13 of their reply brief, and that, to my mind, contains a very important concession. The way Verizon hedges that statement is they say a common carrier could do that so long as they make the same favorable rate available to others. I'm not quoting precisely, but that's the point they're making. And that exactly proves the Commission's point. Under the common carriage framework, if I give a discount to A, and if it costs me the same to provide the same service to B, I must give the same discount to B, because the only justification I can invoke is cost-based difference or competitive necessity, which is a different category that's sort of indirectly related to cost.
Are there other examples that you could give us?
Another example. Yeah. Suppose I enter into a data roaming agreement with you, Judge Tatel. 3 months later, it turns out I'm getting requests for data roaming from a number of providers, and I figure out demand has really picked up. So 3 months later, provider B comes to me and says, you know what, I'd like the same deal provider A got. And I say, well, you know what, I think I can charge more because there's more interest in this service and the market's changed and things have picked up. Again, we think that would be commercially reasonable under this rule. Again, I'm assuming for all of these examples there's no effort to freeze out competition. But we think it's commercially reasonable to charge more because B is prepared to pay more because the market conditions have changed. And that would clearly not be allowed under the common carriage framework that applies to the voice roaming rule. Again, look at the cases we cite at page 43 of our brief, American Trucking Association and Western Union, which both involve discounts. And the court agreed with the commission that if you don't show that your discount is justified by cost differences, too bad, that's not allowed under common carriage principles. And we say it is allowed under the data roaming rule, provided, again, there's no effort to restrain trade.
What about the example that Ms. Walker ended with? Example, I think, of a new entrant who they weren't yet sure of what the consequences would be.
I'm not sure I fully recall the precise example.
I've been writing so quickly that I haven't been able to. It was the one that we discussed with respect to whether it was a technical issue or whether it came within one of the other exceptions provided in the regulation.
Well, please let me know if I'm not being responsive here. One defense that is expressly allowed under the data roaming rule but is not in the voice roaming rule is a comparison of the generation of wireless technology. So in simple terms, that means if I'm AT&T and I have a 4G network and some other provider comes to me and says, I would like you to give me data roaming, but I have a 3G network. And let's even say that they have phones, cell phones, that they give to their customers that would work on 4G. It's 4G-enabled phones, but their network is 3G. We have said in the data roaming order that the host is fully entitled to reject that request. And I think this underscores the latitude Judge Griffith talked about in terms of discretion. I hope that's responsive to Your Honor's question. But if the court's looking for other examples, one that comes to mind is, suppose I'm a host and A and B come to me with requests for like service, for data roaming. And I happen to know that B is a regional carrier that has a customer base that tends to travel more frequently for business into my service area. Let's say A is a national carrier. They have no particular focus on this area, but they want a data roaming agreement. I might infer that B has a greater need for data roaming, and again, we think it may be commercially reasonable for me to charge B more than to charge A for equivalent service, even where it costs me the same. And again, going back to the paradigm of the common carriage framework that applies to the voice roaming rule, that would clearly be impermissible. So all of these examples, I think, illustrate that there is simply no basis for the suggestion that the Commission was engaging in pure semantics when it said commercially reasonable instead of just reasonable and non-discriminatory.
So where do you draw the line between permissible requirements, which you argue is this case, and impermissible ones? What could the Commission, how do you draw the line? We have to write an opinion.
Absolutely.
And we have to deal with Ms. Walker's argument that if we open the door,
absolutely.
Right? It's endless. So what's the principle?
Here is a principle distinction. Yeah. If the Commission had said, we hereby extend the rule that applies to voice roaming, that embeds within it And one can look at 20.12d, which is the text of the voice roaming rule, and you will see there an express reference to 201 and 202. If we simply carried that over to the...
That doesn't tell me how to distinguish the two cases. You've told me they're different. You've said what the data roaming rule here is okay, but imposing the voice roaming rule would not. What's the principal distinction between them, other than the different cases?
The principal distinction, I believe, Your Honor, is the requirement to hold out on the same terms and conditions would be classic common carriage. This is not such a condition because it gives hosts flexibility, latitude, considerable discretion to offer different deals to different requesting parties, depending on the circumstances. And there is a broader range of factors that can...
And you locate that difference in the phrase commercially reasonable?
Commercially reasonable and various specific statements in the order, such as paragraph 45. Hosts are not required to hold themselves out to serve all comers indiscriminately on the same or standardized terms. Paragraph 68. Providers will have flexibility with regard to roaming charges. Again, paragraph 68, they can negotiate different prices with different parties.
But why is that the right standard? I mean, you're relying, excuse me, on Southwest Bell here, right? The traditional mark of common carrier service, that's what you're saying.
That's one of the cases.
But the argument that Verizon makes is that if you look at the other limitations that are imposed on them, they add up to the equivalent of common carrier.
I think that's a very bizarre argument, Your Honor, for this reason. The whole point about the data roaming framework is it is more flexible. It gives more latitude. So it would be quite perverse, I would submit, to not have the same defenses and immunities, what are called in these orders limitations, such as technical compatibility, various caveats like that say a host under these circumstances does not need to provide service. It would be quite perverse not to at least give data roaming hosts those limitations or those defenses plus additional flexibility. So I think the fact that there is some overlap between the defenses, limitations, safe harbors, whatever you want to call them, really doesn't speak to the salient issue here, which is this common carriage? Is this a requirement to indiscriminately offer a service on generally applicable terms? And the order made perfectly clear repeatedly that it is absolutely not that. And moreover, to the extent Verizon has made suggestions about how the commission may cross the line into common carriage in applying this rule in any particular case, well, as the court has pointed out, they could freely make that argument in the context of an as-applied challenge to any particular adjudication under these rules. But we submit that reading the order on its face, there is no basis to believe this is impermissible common carriage. We furthermore submit that whatever arguments Verizon makes about the outer limits of Title III jurisdiction here, it is quite plain that what the Commission did here was within the heartland of its Title III authority, specifically under 303B, among other provisions.
Do you think you agree with the Metro PCS's suggestion that the commission can, that 3B is all you need? 303B?
I would say this.
That's their argument.
3B would be sufficient, but I don't think the commission should be precluded from...
That wasn't the question I asked you.
Okay.
Their argument is that that's all you need, and... What do you think about that?
If that is supposed to imply that the other provisions cited do not provide authority.
No, it didn't. I don't think they said that. I said, setting aside whether those do or not, 303B is all you need.
I think 303B in and of itself would be enough to justify what the commission did, but there was nothing wrong.
What's the argument? How do you respond to Ms. Walker's argument that this actually really goes beyond prescribing terms, that that's not what this is? This is telling them who they have to serve.
Well, that would be a Chevron issue, Your Honor, and it's a perfectly reasonable construction to say any rule that tells hosts what they have to do is about prescribing the nature of service. Now, I believe my friend's brief cites a case purportedly for the proposition that 3B is only about limitations on service, but that would simply make no... first of all, we don't believe the case says that, and secondly, it wouldn't really make any sense of what the 303B says on its face. It says that you shall be able to prescribe the nature of the service. So we think that 303B is plainly sufficient, but we don't see any error in relying on the additional provisions, and we think that the Commission was correct to rely on the additional provisions.
Okay, thank you. Ms. Walker, you did use up all your time. Oh, I'm sorry. We have an intervener. My apologies.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Yes, I'm sorry.
I rarely raise my hand when I'm
here. Really sorry. It's after 12, but you go ahead.
Thank you so much, Your Honor. And may it please the Court, Richard Bress for the competitive interveners. I know I have a short time, so I'll just try to make three short points. First of all, contrary to Verizon's representation here today, the Commission had good reason for instituting this rule and didn't act arbitrarily and capriciously by thinking that there was a need to be served. Paragraphs 24 to 27 of the order lay out part of what we know to be the real-life story, of course, which is that this is a dangerously concentrated industry dominated by two super carriers right now, each of whom have more than 30% of the market, and in certain areas for certain services essentially are the sole have the sole ability to provide roaming. We also know that until this order was in the offing, Verizon and AT&T were stonewalling requests for roaming, giving very few roaming arrangements, if any, and that they had a last-minute conversion as the rule was just about to go into place. Without roaming, of course, millions of our customers remain without the ability to have data roaming, which means that they can't even check for their emails when they're outside of their home area. Plainly, this has a great effect on competition and on access. Plenty of reason for this rule. Secondly, Chevron...
Where do you locate the Commission's authority to deal with that problem?
In 303B primarily, Your Honor. I think 316 as well. But when you're defining what the limits of 303B are, at least primarily, you know, I look to NBC, which says that essentially the public interest in terms of defining the nature of the service is the primary place you look to, because that's what the statute actually says for saying what they can do. Now, plainly, you can't make a wireless carrier in the public interest own a professional basketball team and operate how they play. But you certainly can define what they do with their wireless service, which is essentially all that's at issue here. Secondly, and it's sort of odd for me to be the one bringing up Chevron, but I will, this is a Chevron case. And the fact that in Midwest Video 2, in NARUC 1, this court said that the agency can't just make up and decide for itself willy-nilly what is common carrier service by putting a label on it. It doesn't mean that the term is entirely self-defining all the time and there's no discretion to define it. I think in this case, Your Honors, the worst that the FCC does is win on Chevron, because if we look to the case law about what common carriage is, repeatedly this court and the Supreme Court have said holding yourself out to serve all comers indifferently or indiscriminately. What they mean by that is not just serving all comers. You'd stop the sentence there if you meant that. What they mean is no discrimination. There is no anti-discrimination component to this rule whatsoever. If you look at paragraph 85, it just says you can discriminate where there are differences in facts. It doesn't say you cannot discriminate if they're not. You can't find that anywhere in the order or in the rule. The rule makes very clear that if A and B are offered different terms and conditions, and they're both commercially reasonable, that's okay, and there's nothing in the rule that says it's not. I'd just like to address one connected point because I think it's likely to come up in rebuttal, and that's a case called Orloff. This court is familiar with it. In Orloff, this court upheld the FCC's ability to allow a common carrier to determine terms and conditions essentially by negotiating with consumers. I think the court referred to it as haggling. What that case was about was not defining what common carriage is. The FCC started out with the proposition, and this court started out with the proposition, that the CMRS provider, as a matter of statute, was a common carrier. The question was whether allowing these differences in terms and conditions based on haggling or negotiating with consumers was consistent with a non-discrimination requirement. What the court held was that the FCC did not abuse its authority to go beyond its level of deference in deciding that in a highly competitive market, the market forces themselves would ensure that any differences in price and terms and conditions were not unreasonable. This case is, of course, very different from that. This is not a competitive marketplace. We can't rely on terms and conditions that are negotiated to be non-discriminatory, and yet there is no non-discrimination requirement here. So this lacks what is this court and the Supreme Court have said for many years to be a central pillar of what common carrier service is about, which is you can't discriminate among customers.
Isn't the question in Orloff different from the question we have here? The question here is not whether the commission can allow certain types of behavior by a common carrier, but whether the commission can impose on an entity that is statutorily precluded from being a common carrier type requirements.
Absolutely.
Aren't those different questions?
I think they're entirely different questions, okay. Your Honor.
Right.
I think that, you know, what Orloff was dealing with was the outer bounds of what 201 and 202
permit. So why did you bring up Orloff? I'm confused.
Well, I only bring it up, Your Honor, because I think that it's fair to explore the question of whether, since Orloff says that unreasonable discrimination, the requirement against unreasonable discrimination, can be dealt with by allowing negotiations in a competitive right. market, whether similarly there can be an argument, which Verizon made in its brief, that the allowance for negotiation in this case is not inconsistent with common carriage. And all I meant to say, Your Honor, is that allowing free negotiation in a market that is not competitive leaves you no protection whatsoever against discrimination. So while we, the competitive carriers here, actually wanted a 201 and 202 type common carriage regime, we wanted that. We thought that that was necessary and important for us. It's not what the commission gave us. What the commission actually gave us is something less. We can't complain about discrimination under this rule. Our inability to complain about discrimination means this isn't common carriage.
Okay, but how do we, I understand your point, and I'll ask you the same question I asked the commission, which is, I mean, your argument is the line is drawn at the indiscriminate offering of services on similarly terms, right? That's the Southwest Bell standard.
That's right, Your Honor.
And if it doesn't do that, it's okay, correct?
That's right, Your Honor.
Why? Isn't it possible that the cumulative effect of the other requirements make it too much like a common carrier requirement to tolerate under this particular statute, which bars the commission from treating these entities as common carriers?
Your Honor,
do we know that's where the line is?
Your Honor, I'll be frank. I don't think we know exactly where uh-huh. the line is. In other words, I don't think that the case law clarifies with precision and exactitude exactly what the courts have meant.
Well, all
when
we
they've
have
said
is
that
Midwest
the core...
Video 2. That's it, right?
What's that, Your Honor?
That's all we have is Midwest Video 2.
Well,
isn't that right?
No, Your Honor, we don't. This court, of course, has Southwestern Bell. I'll give you another example, actually, a great example, which is NARUC 2. In NARUC 2, the court said that it was very difficult to square price discrimination with common carriage. Now, it went on to allow it despite some discrimination in that case, but that's because the discrimination was in favor of certain public entities. Mm-hmm. So the court basically said that's an exception to the rule. But the rule that the court was operating from is when you allow price discrimination, you're not talking about common carriage. Now, look, I'm not going to pretend to you, as I've just said,
again,
that this is clear as a bell.
That's a different question, isn't it, from, we just went through that. That's a different question from the question we're facing here.
I think what we're facing here is what is the mm-hmm. core of common carriage, where if the FCC ventures into that mm-hmm. with a private mobile carrier, it's not allowed to do that. So defining where that core is, mm-hmm. I think is very much part of this case. I think that the best reading of where that core is that you're not a common carrier, regardless of other factors, if You're only required to serve, but you're not required to serve indiscriminately. Now, there may be arguments at the edges of this, Your Honor, and it may be that somebody, the FCC, would have the ability in another case to say, but there's a host of other factors here that make this essentially like common carriage. But then we're operating in, I think, an area where neither case law nor the words themselves give us a definite enough meaning to tell the FCC that it's wrong. I think that that's what you would need to rule against the FCC here is actual clarity that says these factors combined together make this common carriage. We're so far from that. Indeed, if you look at the other factors, let's go beyond non-discrimination for a second. If you look at commercially reasonable. Now, just and reasonable, we know what that means. Just and reasonable has traditionally meant that it has to be justified either by cost or with a the notion that there's a competitive market that under which the prices are going to approach marginal cost. Those are really the two theories that have traditionally been used to say what just and reasonable pricing is. The Commission has not in the least limited itself by saying that the price and terms and conditions here have to be commercially reasonable to those two particular ways of thinking about things. So not only don't we have an anti-discrimination requirement, we don't have a just and reasonable requirement, which again is a hallmark of what common carriage has long meant.
Would commercially reasonable include the opportunity of Verizon to take into consideration its market dominant position and price far higher than it might in a situation where it doesn't, where it's faced with competitors?
Your Honor, I think in some ways, and I don't mean to duck because I'll answer the question, but let me start just with a caveat, which is I think that the Commission's going to have to flesh an awful lot of this out as it's looking at how to apply the rule. But I will say that we're talking about a market that everyone knows is not a competitive market. And the question here is whether the dominant carrier's pricing in this competitive market is commercially reasonable. Nothing that the Commission has said thus far would limit those carriers to a price that would obtain in an effectively competitive marketplace.
Obviously, there are lots of marketplaces that are not competitive, and in those marketplaces, commercially reasonable prices are not the same price you would have if you had a competitive equilibrium.
That's right, Your Honor.
Is that the FCC's contemplation here, as far as you can tell, from their order, that they would be able to price above the price that might be available in a competitive market?
I don't think that there's anything in the order that would preclude the FCC from reaching that conclusion, Your Honor. And I think that that's all that we really need to resolve this case is they haven't imposed a standard that would limit its discretion to approving only prices that are essentially effectively competitive market prices. They've given themselves quite a lot more leeway than that. And I think commercially reasonable is something that we're going to have to wait until further litigation and a case-specific look to know exactly how it's going to be applied.
Thank you.
You're quite welcome, Your Honors.
So, Ms. Walker, you did use up your time, but we used up a lot of it. So you can take 5 minutes if you'd like it.
Thank you very much. I'll start with 303B. Mm-hmm. The text of that statute says that the Commission can prescribe the nature of the service to be rendered. Nature means kind, sort, type. For instance, broadcast, microwave, cellular. That's what the Commission up to this point has done under 303B. It doesn't, the use of the word nature doesn't, I think, encompass regulatory dictates, including, as Mr. Bress said, what we do, or how we do it, or who we do it with. Carroll Brothers, pardon me?
Why not?
To prescribe?
I know that's the way you interpret it, but why is nature limited that way? What?
I think the dictionary definition of nature is kind or sort or type. And again, also the context matters. Mm-hmm. The 303 is about organizing the spectrum. It doesn't say anything. Judge Garland asked some interesting questions about competition, standards, pricing and such. There's nothing, not only in 303B, but anything in 303 that talks about antitrust type considerations like that. I think it reads also the basic provisions of Title II into 303B, and Congress specifically decided not to do that. In your AT&T case, you had a much clearer delegation of authority. There, the commission was allowed to adopt verification procedures. That was the statutory text, and you said that wasn't close enough. Here, I think we have even language that is farther from their point. Importantly,
could you give us any context for that? Generally encourage larger and more effective use of radio.
The commission didn't rely on 303G, Your Honor.
Well, it did cite it.
It cited it as supportive of the rule. It didn't include it in paragraph 63, where they said the following provisions establish our authority.
Right, but you were saying the context of the statute, and you were certainly citing other parts of the statute.
Oh, I'm sorry.
And so I was just wondering whether that gives a suggestion that it's not just management of the spectrum and who gets which part of the spectrum, but that it has more meaning than that.
I think 303G is just about encouraging, you know, some interesting uses and such, but I don't think that goes, again, to what we do, who we do it with, and how we do it on regulated terms and conditions, including prices. Importantly, I listened to both lawyers on the other side. I did not hear a good answer to Judge Tatel's question about the limiting principle on 303B. They still haven't come up with one. To repeat the language of the statute, as Mr. Karanja did, is not a limiting principle, nor is it a limiting principle for Mr. Bress to say it was a good idea, which is essentially what the commission's test here was.
Their standard is the Southwest Bell standard. That's what they're proposing. Indiscriminate offering on generally applicable terms. My question to them was why that standard?
Actually, Southwestern Bell helps us, so I'm generally confused about why they keep pointing to it. What Judge Wall said in Southwestern Bell was that the key was the holding out of the service to all takers. That's also what you said in CSI Aviation and the Orient Express case. We have that here. We are being required to offer the service to all those who want to use it and can make technical use of it. That meets the Southwestern Bell test. She also explained that in NAROC 1, you said to qualify as a private carrier, you have to possess the discretion to be able to decide whether and on what terms to deal. I think that means it's a binary test. It's been repeated over and over as a binary test for who is a private carrier. So if you don't possess the discretion to decide whether to deal, by definition, you don't qualify as a private carrier.
His argument was is that the core is actually that there's no non-discrimination requirement here.
Well, that's never been an absolute requirement of common carrier status. And what Mr. Karanja said is that we have to, it would only be common carrier regulation if we had to offer the service on the same terms. That's flatly wrong, Your Honors. Even 201 has always allowed reasonable discrimination. It's never been a test for identical terms and conditions. So that's just smoke and mirrors. There's always been some play in the joints there.
NAROC 1 and NAROC 2 are both before Chevron, aren't they?
Yes.
So the court didn't face the question we have, which is assume for the moment that we think Chevron applies. They had no choice but to pick a definition they thought was the better. Even if you're completely right about both of those cases, isn't that a fundamental difference between those cases and this one?
Well, the Supreme Court kind of faced that question out of the last term in Home Concrete, actually. And even though a case comes up before Chevron, they still use that language of discretion versus a sufficiently clear provision. And Chevron puts a gloss on that, to be sure, but I think that when this court said the terms are sufficiently definite, I think was the language, that the commission, that they don't admit of commission discretion, I think that just is maybe a somewhat old-fashioned way, but the pre-Chevron way of saying that the statute is clear. I still never heard a limiting principle on 303B, and I think that's an important point. It can't be in the heartland. What they've done here can't be in the heartland of 303B, as Mr. Cron just said, because there's not a single case supporting it. They point to NBC in the public interest language. There was a pretty specific of delegation of authority in that case. 303I said the commission had authority to engage in regulations regarding chain broadcasting. So NBC gets cited a lot, But 303i is pretty specific. It's not support for using 303b in this way. This is substantive economic regulation that requires us to deal with others and even regulates our price. I think to read that into 303b would really be to wrench the statute out of context, to read provisions of Title II in effect into this section that Congress never chose to do. And I think it would really open up Pandora's box in terms of allowing the commission to regulate broadband, something this court has never allowed. Thank you.
Thank you. The case is submitted.